This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Wow. First of all, may I say how nice it is to see everybody. How many of you are just new today? Good. A lot of people new and a lot of people coming back. Thank you. My name is Misha Kaun, and I have been leading a different group that is associated with San Francisco Zen Center for about 33 years, and literally just the weekend before last had a big ceremony of stepping down from that role. And so this is a big transition time for me, because at the same time, I was invited to become a teacher here last November. So the last, since November, there's been a lot of overlap, and I'm actually glad that this is my big responsibility now, just to be here. But the people in my group decided that they were not going to seek another teacher right away. There's many people in the group who've been practicing with me for over 30 years. And so they decided to follow a model that's out there of having peer leadership. So there's about five people who are sharing the leadership at this time. Eventually, I think they may look around for a teacher, but having a teacher is a very personal thing. Years ago, my second teacher, Blanche Hartman at San Francisco Zen Center, was getting very old, and it was a long trip for me back and forth. And she said, "Oh, why don't you try this teacher he's a Vipassana teacher, but he also has Zen training. He's down in the Bay Area, you know, down here." And you know, I said, "Okay." And he is a wonderful teacher, and he has many students. And we really like each other, but something just wasn't there. And when I went back to my teacher, Blanche, I explained this, and she's, affinity. A Zen teacher, you have to have a feeling of affinity. There has to be something there about that person that speaks to you, because the Dharma itself is pure. You can't do anything about that. But the vessel may have some big cracks, and you have to decide if you're willing to put up with those particular cracks. Anyway, many of my students were not thrilled about me stepping down, although they understood why it was time. I'm getting old. I'm getting ready to move a little bit away from this area, not too far. I have glaucoma, which means that driving at night is very hard for me. And we were meeting every Monday evening and alternate Saturdays. So it was time. And it also feels very appropriate for me to be here. I just live 20 minutes down the road. But because they were expressing so much concern, at one point I shared a wonderful story, a Zen story. There's a master who's dying, and all his monks are weeping and wailing. And finally he says, "Well, why? I don't understand. Why are you all crying?" "Well, because you're leaving us, master." He says, "Leaving? Where is it you think I could go?" This is really very profound. How many of you have lost someone very important to you? A parent, an aunt, a grandmother, a child? Yeah, pretty much everyone. It happens. It's what happens. We have a body. The Buddha understood this intimately, that the real suffering is not about the body. We're going to suffer because we have a body, but he concentrated on the other kind of suffering that we do to ourselves. But when we really finally understand this practice and our life, what we understand is that nobody ever actually leaves, because we are all part of each other. And this is not some philosophical airy-fairy thing that I'm saying. It's actually completely, honestly, the truth of the matter. When you leave today, some part of me has become a part of you, just because you're here listening to what I have to say. And when I talk to some of you afterwards, some part of you is going to become me. We are all a complete composite of every person we have ever known and every situation we have ever been in. Each thing has brought us to this moment, right here, right now. And so I have long conversations with my father, who died 20 years ago. This is because I was very close to him. He died at 73, and I am almost 73 now. It was, from many people's point of view, it was too young, but within the same month, a little girl in my school died at the age of 15. So from my point of view, 73 was a reasonable amount of time. But when I talk to him, I hear his voice and I hear his wisdom. And because we knew each other so well, I know what he's going to say to me. Because he's not out there. He's not ashes. He's right here inside of me. So at the end of his life, the Buddha said, "Be a light unto yourself." These are not fanciful words, and they are not to be taken lightly. We cannot rely on a teacher for our understanding of our life. We can't rely on books, however wonderful they might be. I've certainly been impressed with many of the books that I have read. And even fiction often contains incredible, wonderful knowledge and insight. We can also not depend on anyone's reputation as a teacher or as a business partner or as the CEO of our company. In the long run, we have to rely on ourselves. We have to shine that light inward. So in one of the famous sutras written by Zen Master Dogen, who lived from 1200 to 1250, it's the Fukan Zazengi, he says, "Therefore, put aside the intellectual practice of investigating words and chasing phrases, and learn to take the backward step that turns the light and shines it inward." Now, in the beginning of our practice, of course we rely on a teacher. We come to a Zen center, we assume that there's going to be some kind of information and instruction. And this is normal. This is what we do. When we want to find out about something, we want to learn how to paint watercolors, we have someone who knows how to do it, show us how it's done. And maybe we practice with that person for many, many years, which is what I did in college. I had a wonderful watercolor teacher, and I was an art student. And year after year after year, quarter after quarter, I took his class until finally came the day when I went off in my own direction. But I had been given a good foundation. I knew how to do it. And then I had to rely on that light shining inward to figure out what to do next. So there's a very famous teacher whose name is Okamura Sensei. And he became the student of an even more famous teacher, Uchiyama Roshi. And when Okamura was going to become a student of Uchiyama Roshi, he was in Japan at the time. Okamura's father went to Uchiyama Roshi because he was also a Zen teacher. And he said to him, "Please take good care of my son." later, when Uchiyama was meeting with Okamura, he said to him, you know, this is what your father said to me, but I cannot do it. My way is to follow the path of the Buddha. If you wish, you can walk that way with me, but I cannot take care of you. This is a grown-up practice. The teachers are not your mom or your dad or even your aunt and uncle. And they are, hopefully, examples of the way. But you're the one that has to do the practice. You're the one that has to sit down on that cushion and over again find that your body is uncomfortable, that your legs are getting all whacked out, that your back is beginning to hurt, that your mind is going in a million directions. And to keep coming back when you realize that it's gone off, come back to here. So there's a famous Tibetan teacher, Asvaghosa, and he wrote something called the Buddha Karita, which means the acts of the Buddha, which is exactly about what I'm saying. It says, do not believe in anything simply because you have heard it. Do not believe in anything simply because it is spoken and rumored by many. Do not believe in anything simply because it is found written in your religious books. Do not believe in anything merely on the authority of your teachers and elders. Do not believe in traditions because they have been handed down for many generations. But after observation and analysis, when you find that anything agrees with reason and is conducive to the good and benefit of one and all, then accept it and live up to it. This was why I ended up staying with Zen practice. When I first went to practice in 1984, which is long before many of you were even born, I'm pretty sure, I went because my life felt a little empty. I had gotten to a place where I had everything that I was told I was supposed to be getting. I had wonderful employment, had a great husband, had a dog, had a nice place to live. I had made it. And I was in my late 20s. And there was a part of me that was like, is that all there is? Did I miss something? I mean, I've checked all the boxes and I'm still not feeling complete. I had been raised as a Catholic. And I think one of the things that I missed were the forms. You know, there was an expectation every Sunday you went to church, right? And you genuflected and you said some words and you had some community. And then when I was 18, I said, that's it. I'm done with you. I can't really get behind a lot of the things that you're saying, especially about women. And so then I didn't do anything except read. I've always been a big reader. So I read everything I could get my hands on, philosophy, religion, did a lot of drugs, I have to confess also. And as they say, that was a door to perception. But I also realized you can't do that for the rest of your life. But I thought, you know what? If drugs can do that in my brain, then my brain can do it by itself. But how? And then as I was reading, I kept, it didn't matter. It didn't have to be a Buddhist book. It was something else. It would say, well, you know, and the Zen masters of old would say, blah, blah, blah. And after that happened about six times, I'm a slow learner. I said, who the hell are these guys? I had never heard of Zen. I had never heard of Buddhism. I had a sheltered childhood. So I got me a book that I'm not supposed to pay any attention to, by the way. It turned out it was, quote, the wrong book. It was called Zen and Japanese Culture. And it was written in 1950. I'm reading it at this point, 1980. And in this book, everything I'm reading, I'm going, yeah? Yeah. Oh, it was as if everything I had sort of come to on my own was all finally in one place. Except there was one problem. In the book, it basically said, if you wanted to study Zen, you had to go to Japan. Well, that wasn't going to happen right away because I had a job and I didn't think that my husband was interested in going to Japan. So I started sitting meditation on my own. And that was nice as far as it went. And then it just, you know, there are serendipitous events that happen in our life, but we have to be ready for them. It's that old, you know, when the student is ready, the master appears. Well, that was my case. We had a roommate for a while. She loved to cook. And she understood that I had this affinity for all things Japanese. And it was true. So she found out there was a UC Extension course up in the city called Seasons and Cooking in Japanese Culture. She figured that covered all the bases for us. So we went. And I just happened to sit next to someone who had just come back from Japan. Now, meanwhile, I have started a series of paintings called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I didn't know there was a book called that. It was a phrase that was in this book written in 1950. So I was trying to express my understanding in my abstract paintings at that point. Anyway, this woman and I start talking during the lunch period. And she says she just got back from Japan. It's like, oh, I've always wanted to go and, you know, study Zen there. And, you know, I've started this new series called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And she looks at me quite innocently and she says, oh, do you practice? It's like, I figured she wasn't talking about piano. I was like, no. Why, do you? Oh, yeah, I go to this place down in Mountain View. Mountain View, I say. So this was a Saturday. The very next Wednesday, I find myself at the Zen Center in Mountain View. The rest, as they say, is history. Because the moment I walked in, it was actually an experience. I have no idea why I had it. I had never seen a Zendo. I'd seen a Japanese house at the Huntington Gardens with the beautiful tatami, and you can see from one end to the other, and that was the beginning of the little seven-year-old girl thinking, I like this stuff. But I had never seen a Zendo. And when the person who was giving Zazen instruction opened the sliding door to the Zendo, and I looked in, I had the most bizarre feeling of complete recognition and familiarity. It's like I had been waiting for this place my whole life and not even knowing it. But I hadn't read Asvaghosa at that point. And I had, I think, this mistaken idea of the teacher as guru. Take that out of your head right now. That is not our practice. I have been practicing for 40 years, 41 now, 42, something like that. Doesn't mean anything. Because my understanding can't be your understanding. Any of the teachers here, what we are doing is we're pointing a finger at the moon. The moon is it. The moon is the Dharma, but you yourself have to get there. We can point a finger, as Uchiyama said, If you wish, you can walk that way with me, but I cannot take care of you. Even if I could find a way to say all the magic words that would open your mind, it's still my experience, not yours. And that's why we have what is called a practice. And it is like piano in that sense. If you got to do it a whole lot to get anywhere at all, but we're always talking about not getting anywhere. But the way I think of it, Suzuki Roshi once said something very wise. He said, Zen practice is sort of like going out, the fog that we had this morning, going out in a fine mist for a long time. Eventually, you are wet through. You're not trying to be wet through. It happens. And when we talk about great doubt and great faith in Zen practice, the faith is that it will happen. It will happen with or without you as long as you do the work. So Asvaghosa says you shouldn't believe anything simply because you have heard it, or even heard it in your own mind, by the way. There's a wonderful, I used to sit Sashin at Vajrapani down off of Route 9, and they had a bumper sticker that says, don't believe everything you think. How many times have thoughts come into your head and you find yourself believing them until you one day say, wait a minute, whose voice is that? There came a day, for instance, when I said to myself, not being happy with the way something had been done, no, it's just like my mother used to say, if you want a job done right, you've got to do it yourself. And then my Zen voice came up and said, well, yeah, I suppose, but if you do it always yourself, then no one else has a chance to learn how to do it, and you're going to be doing it alone. Oh, this was a tape. It took me a very long time to realize it was my mother's voice in my head. But for me, it wasn't true. So whenever anything arises in your mind, you should not only say, okay, I'm not going to believe everything I read or hear, but also maybe in my own mind, I shouldn't believe everything that arises. This is actually one of the beauties of meditation, is to keep saying, really? Are you sure? Think about this again. He also says you shouldn't believe anything simply because you read it somewhere. Many of us in the early days read a wonderful book, and maybe you have too, called The Three Pillars of Zen. It's a great book. Unfortunately, it's all about enlightenment experiences. And so what ends up happening is you're like, okay, I want that. And then you come and it's all this hard work on the cushion, boring, boring, boring. What's going on? Wait, where's my enlightenment experience? It doesn't happen that way. I can tell you that from experience. It also does not happen to be the case that you should listen to any one particular teacher. So many years ago, after my teacher Blanche died, I was looking around for another teacher. And there was a man at San Francisco Zen Center who I knew somewhat. I knew his wife also. She was also a teacher there. And I had been watching him for years. It's the best way. You just watch someone. You observe what they do. So I wrote him and I said, may I come and talk to you? Here's my situation. I don't have a teacher. I am a teacher for other people. And I feel like teachers should always have teachers, you know, because teachers can get to be ambitious or arrogant or think they know something. And their teacher then knocks them down a few pegs. So I went to visit him and we're having this great conversation. And then finally he says, so have you listened to any of my lectures? I think he thought he was asking me a trick question. I looked at him and I said, nope. never listened to any of your lectures. He was a little taken aback by that. And I said, you want to know why? Yeah. Lots of people can give a good talk. I give good talks. I have been told that. It doesn't mean a damn thing. It just means I know how to give good talks. And I have been giving talks practically my entire life. I come from a long line of storytellers. It is why I became a librarian. It's all about telling stories. And you get good at it. But it doesn't mean you should listen to anything I'm saying. And with that, this teacher started laughing. It's like, got it. And we ended up having wonderful conversations because he understood. I didn't care what he said in a lecture. What I cared about, I told him, I said, I have been watching you for years at Zen Center. How you get up, how you sit down, how you relate to the people, what you do in a ceremony, what you do in regular situations like this. I have been watching from afar. You're the real deal. Not everybody is. So observe, watch, have affinity. And also he says, don't believe anything just because it's a tradition that's been handed down for centuries. You know, there are very famous stories of, you know, burning the Buddha. Right? I love the traditions in Zen practice. I love offering incense and bowing. All of those things make sense to me. But they are not it. What those things are for are to bring you back to a state of attention. And when we're bowing, you know, I'm offering each one of those bows for a specific person or group of people. Starts with the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, and then it's my dead teachers, my living teachers, my dead family members. Then it's my current family, my husband's family, and then it is for all my Sangha and everyone who has asked me for help recently. That's all 9 bows. But Asvaghosa, then he ends it so wonderfully. He says, but after observation and analysis, in other words, critical thinking, which is not being used much these days in our country, when you find that anything agrees with reason and is conducive to the good and benefit of one and all, then accept it and live up to it. What a wonderful thing to live up to. Something that is reasonable, that speaks to your heart as well as your head, that you have looked and you have watched and you have analyzed it, you have thought about it, you have questioned it, when it is for the good of all. That you must do. You must accept and do that practice. In another very famous sutra by Dogen as well, the Genjo Koan, he says, this is his most famous thing. To study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. When you first seek Dharma, you imagine you are far away from its environs. But Dharma is already transmitted. You are immediately, right now, your original self. And why does Dogen recommend studying the self as opposed to studying books or even his own writings? Because here's the best part about meditation. You are the scientist studying, and you are also the science experiment. You are both in one. Nobody knows you like you do. This is why you will get frustrated when you go into your doctor or your car mechanic and you're trying to explain what's wrong. You know there's something wrong because you know better than they do. But trying to get them to understand what's wrong, that's the work. Each of you is a child of the Buddha, or God, or the cloud of unknowing, or a child of the universe, whatever you want to call it, it doesn't really matter to me. You belong here. You have a right to be here. And you are not alone. You are connected with every single thing. You were born in purity, and you will die that way. And when you are upset with people, or there are people that you don't like, or you don't wish loving kindness to, what you need to remember is that person was also born in purity. The difficulty for us are causes and conditions that bring us to now. So there are people out there causing a great deal of difficulty. They do not care about other people. They are not concerned about being for the benefit of one and all. But this is due to causes and conditions. And when you are wishing loving kindness, please wish loving kindness to those individuals too. I know it's hard. It's hard for me. But frankly, those are the people that need it the most. So I want to read one last thing about your connection and your purity and where you came from and where you're going. This is the book of Suzuki Roshi, the very first one, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which is a collection of his early lectures. There have been a couple books since, but as you can see, the pages on this one are bent and worn and all kinds of... I've had it for a long time. I went to Yosemite National Park, and I saw some huge waterfalls. The highest one there is 1,340 feet high. And from it, the water comes down like a curtain thrown from the top of the mountain. It does not seem to come down swiftly, as you might expect. It seems to come down very slowly because of the distance. And the water does not come down as one stream, but is separated into many tiny streams. From a distance, it looks like a curtain. And I thought it must be a very difficult experience for each drop of water to come down from the top of such a high mountain. It takes time, you know, a long time, for the water finally to reach the bottom of the waterfall. And it seems to me that our human life may be like this. We have many difficult experiences in our life. But at the same time, I thought the water was not originally separated. It was one whole river. Only when it is separated does it have some difficulty in falling. It is as if the water does not have any feeling when it is one whole river. Only when separated into many drops can it begin to have or to express some feeling. When we see one whole river, we do not feel the living activity of the water. But when we dip a part of the water into a dipper, we experience some feeling of the water, and we also feel the value of the person who uses the water. Feeling ourselves and the water in this way, we cannot use it in just a material way. It is a living thing. Before we were born, we had no feeling. We were one with the universe. This is called mind only, or essence of mind, or big mind. After we are separated by birth from this oneness, as the water falling from the waterfall is separated by the wind and the rocks, then we have feeling. And you have difficulty because you have feeling. You attach to the feeling you have without knowing just how this kind of feeling is created. When you do not realize that you are one with the river or one with the universe, you have fear. Whether it is separated into drops or not, water is water. Our life and death are the same thing. When we realize this fact, we have no fear of death anymore, and we have no actual difficulty in our life. This is what it means at the end of another sutra, the Jijuyu Zamai. This being so, the zazen of even one person at one moment imperceptibly accords with all things and fully resonates throughout time. Thus, in the past, the future, and the present of the limitless universe, this zazen carries on the Buddhist teaching endlessly. Each moment of zazen is equally wholeness of practice, equally wholeness of realization. You were waiting for enlightenment. This is it. Sitting down on your cushion is taking your enlightened mind into practice. You have everything you need. Or as the famous writer Leo Tolstoy once said, the kingdom of God is within. Be a light unto yourself. Do your practice. Marvelous things are going to happen. Thank you. It's 11:20. I usually talk too long. That's why I'm laughing. So we have a few minutes or not? 10 minutes. Doubled. This has never happened. So if you have a question, a comment, something you'd like to add, some experience you've had, I would love to hear it. Please don't be shy. And if it's nothing about what I said, that's fine too. You can ask any question you want. Yes. Right. So the han that you all heard out there, the wooden, that phrase is always written on the han. Life is swiftly passing. Do not waste your days in vain. For that very reason. You all want to do something good in the world. For most of us, we're very small people. We're not politicians. We're not usually heads of, Google and Facebook, and you think to yourself, oh, there's nothing I can do. Yes, you can. This is it. Because whatever you think is happening for you, you're going to take it back out into the world. And you don't even have to be aware of how you're taking it out into the world. Something happens here. And you go out into the world and you make a difference that way. Maybe you treat the grocery store clerk nicer than you would have. Maybe when you get on the road, instead of cursing the person who's passing you at 90 miles an hour, you, vaya con Dios. Don't waste your time. There are so many things that we can be distracted by. And they're fun things, right? The movies and books. I mean, I love reading. I told you that. But this is what actually is going to create a miracle inside of you. So, thank you. Yeah.
And some of these that not, they don't have any solution, they don't have any even action. Maybe. But what will you do for your meditation? How you try to not think about the dilemma and hardness, about the positives? Do you have any?
So, for those of you who are online, I'll just summarize. He's asking about. When you're in meditation, how not to be concentrating on whatever your problem is at the moment, but perhaps shifting it into a more positive expression in your zazen. And what do I do with that? First of all, I try not to shift it into positive, okay? Try to keep in neutral. Right? One of the main things, you know, even after all these years of practice, when you have a great difficulty in your life, that is what's going to be arising for you. And what I have found for myself to be true, and what I have to then remind myself, if I would just sit and empty my mind of anything, of the problem, whether it has a solution or not, of, oh, maybe I could do this more positive. No, just following my breath. What happens is the mind begins to calm down and stops thinking altogether, hopefully. There's an old joke about a story of the Zen teacher and his student, and he's pouring tea into the student's cup, and the student's going on and on about this and this and this. And finally he looks at him and says, oh, master, the teacup is overflowing. And the master says, well, yes, that's because you cannot feel. You can't fill an already full teacup. We are all filled teacups. And so until we empty our teacup out, there's no space for anything else to arise. The interesting thing to me is that afterwards, often something will present itself that I never thought of. Because guess what? We are all part of a collective unconsciousness. When we get rid of our small self, our ego self, and make space, something else has the opportunity to arise. Second thing I would say, I used to spend a lot of time worrying, you know, planning, oh, if I could just, you know, if I just, then when I get to that place, then I'll be all ready for it, getting my ducks in order, right? By the time you get to that place, it has changed. And so have you. I have found it is a complete waste of time. You're worrying about something that hasn't happened, and that when you get there, it's completely different than the way you imagined it was going to be. And so all that time you spent in zazen thinking, you could have been emptying out your teacup. So that's what I do. The main thing, I think, is I've offered this as an example before. There was a wonderful teacher who came to give a lecture one time, and he held up his stick, and he had a pretty heavy Japanese accent. He says, so, zazen, he said, zazen, not this, zazen, this. Because a lot of times we don't even realize we're thinking, do we? You know, we're halfway down and we're going down the rabbit hole, and then all of a sudden, it's so wonderful. It's like we have two brains. There's this little brain that says, hello, where are you? He said, this, instead of saying, oh, well, I really want to nudge this a little bit more and think about it a little bit longer. No, no, no. Tell yourself no. Come back to here. Come back to the breath. And then what if, you know, you're going to go back this way. And, oh, no. And you may do that 60 times or 600 times in a 40-minute period. What you're doing is you're developing a muscle. The muscle to let go of this juicy thing, whatever it is that's got your attention, and bring it back just to your breath. Thank you. Great question. Got time for at least another one? And for all. For all, conducive for all.
Yeah. So in today's world, well, I mean, not.
Right.
You do one thing, but for some other part, sometimes confession that also. Foods for the most part, but it's really trouble there. Out of the work part, how do I think?
So the question has to do with trying to do good in the world, something that is conducive to the benefit of all beings. How do we do that? How do we know if we're doing that? How do we know that the good we think we're doing is good across the board? And how to think about that? How to look at that? Great question. Very complex. The founder of this temple, Obinshino Roshi, he once said something, I'm going to have to paraphrase it. He said, you know, when a person realizes that everything they do, don't do, say, don't say, affects everything else, it makes a person want to sit down. That is probably the most important reason that we sit zazen. You started out by saying in this world, and then you said, well, in any world, but it is the case that our world is so much more complicated than the Buddha's was. It doesn't mean that human emotions and suffering has changed, but it's happening at a very rapid pace, and it is a much more complicated and global world, right? The Buddha lived in India. He didn't travel anywhere else. He traveled all throughout India. But there were other civilizations happening that he didn't know anything about. These days, you know everything that's happening in the world all the time. And we, you know, the Eightfold Path includes things like right action, right speech, and right livelihood. You might think, even as a Zen teacher, that I'm doing right livelihood. But I do know that there are religious teachers in the world who end up doing very bad things. Maybe they are not speaking the truth, and maybe behind the scenes they're doing things they shouldn't be doing. So the main reason that we sit in zazen is what Dogen says. To study the way is to study the self. And I wish he had added in the words, for a very long time. You're going to be If you do this practice, you are going to be studying the self for the rest of your life. Because the self, all by itself, is very complicated. You have all got habitual behavioral patterns. I do too. And I know a lot of them, and I work with them. But when I first started practice, I didn't understand 7/8 of who I really was. When you don't know who you are, you cause harm. Because you go out in the world in this completely unaware way. You don't even realize you're causing harm. So an example of what you're asking, just for all of us to get here today, most of us had to drive. We're using fuel. We're killing bugs. You might not think that's very important, but the bug liked its life, right? You're using the rubber on your tires. You've got an ecological footprint just to come and do meditation, which is a good thing to be here. So the early Greeks borrowed things from the Buddhists, by the way. The two most famous things they borrowed was to know thyself. Oh, to study the way is to study the self. He got that from the Buddha. Because the Greeks conquered Gandharan India 300 years after the Buddha died, and his teachings were still alive and well. And they said, oh, that sounds like a good one. Oh, take that back. And the second one they did was cause no harm. This is fundamental Buddhism. There is no way that you can cause no harm. Just know that. No matter how good a person you are, no matter what the best intentions you have, you will cause harm. And so the best you can probably hope for is cause the least amount of harm possible. That is how I work with that. I have a bit of a temper. Most people don't know this about me because I work on it all the time. My husband knows it. This is, if you want to know the true nature of anybody, talk to the person who has to live with them. But I know it about myself, and I know it causes harm. So I work on it all the time. It's not easy. Causes and conditions brought me to this place. I have two parents who had tempers, and they weren't aware of them particularly. So the good news is, at least this generation now, I'm aware of it. So depending on what your work is, be of good cheer. Find a job where you can do mostly good, but know that it may be used for things that weren't exactly in, you know, your wish. Just by paying taxes, folks, which you have to do by law, you are supporting things that maybe politically you don't want to support. You could do what Akin Roshi did and stop paying taxes a long time ago. For some reason, they never did put him in jail. But I think if we all said, oh, we're not going to pay our taxes because we don't like, people would be coming to our door. So, know thyself to the best of your ability in order to cause the least amount of harm possible. I think we have to stop. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.